Okay. So. Right. Just to give you a little bit of background, this whole project came about. Hang on. Can every. There we go. All right, just to give you a little bit of background on the National Wetland Condition Assessment, it's part of a series of aquatic resource surveys that EPA helps to implement along in partnership with the states and the tribes and with some other partners as well. We have a number of federal partners that are involved in collecting these data. It's a nationwide survey. And the wetland condition assessment has been now done twice, once in 2011, once in 2016. These aquatic resource surveys grew out of the need for better information to report on how effective our programs were. And what we had been doing up to now, folks, I would like to ask, would everybody please mute their lines? We're getting a little bit of feedback in the background, and as I said, we're trying to bridge two sets of technology here. Okay. Thank you. So the origin of these surveys occurred because the data that we were getting were not adequate to report on the effectiveness of our programs to Congress. And so over time, we developed a probability-based survey technology. For the other aquatic resources, and wetlands was the last aquatic resource to be added. They were surveyed in 2011 and in 2016. The purpose of these surveys is, which we have done once every 5 years, is to assess the condition of our waters and to take a look and see is that is the condition of the waters reflecting good efforts on behalf of our pollution prevention programs. All right. The states and the regions have done an enormous amount of coordination and basically we've collaborated at every step of the way. With for the NACA, we had a series of objectives. We wanted to produce a report that would talk about the ecological condition of our wetlands, to identify the stressors that are most commonly associated with poor condition, to give us targets, to identify targets for restoration. We were collaborating with the states and tribes in developing these wetland monitoring tools. Okay, prior to the development, the states had all had input into what they felt were the most important things to look at. All of the parameters that we were monitoring was based on collaborative input and the states and tribes were invaluable in helping us test these protocols before we use them. So, in addition to that, we wanted to help develop wetland monitoring tools, analytical approaches, and data management that we could share with our state and tribal partners, and essentially to advance the science of wetland policy so that we got information that would lead to better protection and restoration of wetlands, both at the national and at the state tribal level. All right, some of the things that this effort has produced has been information on resource condition. It can help inform the reports that the states and tribes provide to us, but especially what it produces is regional tools and measures to evaluate condition. All right. As part of the whole cycle of the NACA, we have provided training to states and tribal members. They have gotten a wealth of experience, and there are stories and legends about these experiences that will go on forever, I think. We've developed new tools and measures for looking at wetlands and for monitoring them, and they probably have wider application beyond just the NACA report. And we have developed good data management technologies. All of this is to increase an understanding of approaches and ways to analyze them. So hopefully these can inform not just our national efforts, but also state and tribal programs and the goals there. All right, the NACA was structured initially, the sample frame was based on the status and trends plots for the Fish and Wildlife Service. These are 2 mile by 2 mile plots. They were based on 9 Amarnik Level 3 ecoregions, which are shown here in the different colors. There were 7 different coordinate-based classes. And one of the things it's important to note is that if you want to report out on a group, you need 50 samples. For whatever the scale is, whatever the size is, you require 50 sample points in order to say something with any statistical rigor about that site. All right, so there were, each of these parameters was made part of the protocols. The USA RAM in 2011 was an overall examination of essentially a rapid assessment, largely based on buffers. These data were then QA'd. The analysts developed indices and metrics of condition and of stress. And the output was estimates of condition for the population, as well as the presence of stressors. Right. If you take a look, what happened in 2011 is part of what led to this effort. The 2011, the 2011 sample was divided into 9 Amarnik Level 3 ecoregions. Problem was that when we did sample them, we didn't get a good enough distribution of points to be able to separate out some of these ecoregions, and so it led to aggregation. And ultimately, we reported out on 4 different ecoregions. If you notice, for example, the West covers almost a third of the lower 48, and the interior plains also covers a significant portion of the country. Whereas if you take a look in what was planned, they were broken up a little bit more. All right, so this is what was, these were the findings of the 2011 condition assessment. Less than half of the wetland area were found to be in good condition, and almost a third were in poor condition. The physical indicators of stress that were most prevalent were alterations to vegetation and hydrology. Wetlands with high stress had either vegetation removal or some kind of hardening. For example, soil compaction. They were twice as likely to be in good condition. The chemical and the biological stressors were not as prevalent nationally. It was these physical indicators, the alterations that were most likely associated with poor condition. But in the West and the interior plains, there's a very high level of non-native plant stress. There are different patterns of condition and stress at the ecoregion level, right? One of the things that struck me, of course, now that I'm working in the West, is that the Western area was found to have only 21% in good condition. 61% of the wetlands were in poor condition, higher than any other area of the country. Again, this shows you the breakout. The interesting thing, though, is that if you take a look, this was the biological condition based on plant, and this was how stress was reported. At the bottom, it shows the West with 61% in poor condition. But if you take a look, you also note that the West also has the lowest area, which is shown in the graph on the right, the lowest area of wetlands. All right, so I'm going to go through these fairly quickly. Most of you are familiar with these. Among the outcomes was a report. It was the first national scale report on the ecological condition of wetlands. The technical companion report documents the procedures that were used to develop, to do quality assurance, and to analyze the indicators that were presented in the public report. It's extremely comprehensive, and this is basically the go-to resource if you want to find out how to do these measures. It's something that I find myself going back to over and over every time I have questions. All right, in terms of how we worked to help try and share capacity, build capacity with our state and tribal partners, in 2011 we had 37 states participating. For some it was the first time they were collecting data. There were some states that used the opportunity to test state-specific assessment methods, and some states did what are known as intensifications, where they did a lot more sample points so that they could report out on condition at their state level. Tribes attended trainings. A number of tribes sampled sites with EPA regional crews. There were tribes that sampled their own sites in 2016 as well. All right, and we have conducted since then a number of tribal training workshops. All right, the scientific outcomes are basically the development of the indicators of both condition and stress. The multimetric index that was used to report on plant condition, known as the VMMI, is a robust index, and each of these subcomponents are also robust indicators on their own merits. Additionally, the physical, chemical, and biological indicators of stress provided some useful information on what things are causing, like wetlands, to be in poor condition. And so it gives us some insights as to what we can work on if we want to improve condition. Right? There is a ton of data, and the data are publicly available and publicly downloadable. And so what these other data offer a lot of opportunities to ask some more detailed questions, both by states and tribes and by the public at large. All right, in 2016, all right, when we first saw the results of these in 2011, in 2016, we took a look and said, whoa, wait a minute, you know, the Western wetlands are in poor condition. Is that real, or is that the result of the fact that we had to aggregate such a huge area? It's two ecoregions, one that is very moist and one that is very dry, the arid West. Also, you're looking at an area that has far fewer wetlands as a whole. So what we did in 2016 was we asked for and got some more sampling plots. All right, if you take a look, this is the location of all the sample plots. The pale ones are over samples. Okay, those are, the dark ones are plots that were originally proposed to sample. The pale ones were over samples. All right, as I had mentioned, these were, the sample frame was originally based on the status and trends plots, but by adding NWI plots into those data, Corvallis was able to give us some better plots in the West, in parts of the West. And the example I'm showing you here is from the Pacific coastal wetlands. So we were able to get a better distribution of plots in the West. All right. As a result, in the Pacific Northwest, which is where we're working, we got 92 plots across three states. And I looked at that and said, ooh, 50 would give us enough to do a condition assessment. Maybe we could look at this area and break it out from the West as a whole. You know, if we had a few more, we might actually be able to separate the arid areas from the mountains, valleys, and coast, which is much more moist. And thanks to both Corvallis and headquarters, we were able to get additional plots added into the mix. And we obtained rare funding so that Corvallis could analyze those results. So what we're going to be doing is a pilot project in the Pacific Northwest, where we will look at these three states, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, and get a sense of whether or not, you know, the condition in the Northwest is different from the rest of the West. And hopefully we can tease out what's different between the arid Pacific Northwest versus the arid Southwest. I think it would allow us to answer a lot of questions at finer scales. All right, this is just showing you the comparison between what we sampled in 2011, which, you know, you have a lot of samples along the coast. There are a lot fewer samples here, particularly in the arid areas. In 2016, we have a much better distribution of sample points. These were the sites that were actually sampled. Okay, as I mentioned, we want to use this information to try and discern differences across the West. And if we can do it between the arid Northwest and the arid Southwest, that would be even better. The states and tribes have interest in monitoring to support their own programs. Most of the states out here have state wetland programs, and an increasing number of our tribes also have tribal wetland programs. And so having this information available can help support those programs. We also noted that, you know, if we can do it here, it's possible that we might be able to ask questions, the same questions of other ecoregions, if we can get a sufficient number of and distribution of points. And that's why we wanted to do this webinar series, so that states that were, and tribes that were interested in doing that work could get a good enough understanding of how the whole probability-based sampling and analysis process works, so that they can be thinking of the right things when they try and plan whether or not they want to do a survey, and if they're going to do it, how they can do it, and what will be involved, at what levels they can ask the questions. Okay, so at the end of this time, in October 2018, we will be holding a workshop. Corvallis is going to be the lead on analyzing the data, but at the workshop, those who participated in the Pacific Northwest in this survey will be actually working with the scientists at Corvallis to learn about how the survey is structured, the components you need, the analysis, and reporting. The webinars we wanted to make available nationwide, because we know that there is an interest in the states and tribes about the nuts and bolts of how to do this. We are hoping to have a set of annotated notes at the end of the workshop to help inform the development of a how-to manual. As I said, the technical report is the go-to resource on how the 2011 assessment was done. And basically, that is what was involved in the development. That's what we hope to achieve. And I think in the interest of time, I'm going to ask anybody to hold questions until the end, because what I'd like to do now is to introduce Tony Olson, who's going to give you the nuts and bolts of what's involved in doing a statistically based design. All right, so I'm going to stop sharing, and I will ask Tony if he will bring his presentation up. Oh man, he's good.
I successfully got to, at least on my screen, a slide of a wetland, which hopefully all of you guys can see. So, let me see if I can do this here. Thank you. So I'm going to give you an overview of sort of a survey design and analysis perspective, or at least a statistical perspective of constructing a monitoring program with a focus on the wetlands. This slide is the obligatory one to make sure that everybody knows that EPA doesn't stand behind anything I say. Cynical person. going to go over the following topics. The first three are really fairly general, and they talk about everything that you need to end up doing before you actually ever get to the point of actually selecting and doing a survey design. Then we're going to talk just very briefly about the survey design itself, and then talk about the data collection process. And one thing that is different for probability-based surveys or survey designs compared to other studies that people tend to do is that not only do you collect response or field measurements, but you also need to collect information about the sites that you actually evaluate to go actually visit. And that's important data that we end up making use of. Where we end up making use of that is the survey design is never implemented exactly as planned. Sites can't be visited, et cetera. We end up making use of the site evaluation results to actually figure out what survey design was actually implemented and how that impacts particularly the weights. And then at the end, we'll talk a little bit about the survey analysis process. More than enough topics to cover in a few minutes. I want to start out with something the National Water Quality Monitoring Council put together back in early 2000s to talk about sort of the monitoring framework. And I think it really is important to actually make sure that everyone actually thinks about it, the process in this way. Every piece actually is interconnected, and it's not just from one piece to the next piece. It's come across pieces in some cases as well. And it's actually, quite frankly, harder to actually implement a monitoring design under a framework than most of us actually want to admit, at least certainly me. If you go back in the literature and you talk about monitoring programs, the literature ends up basically saying, hey, wait a minute, what are the weaknesses of the monitoring program? And quite frankly, one of the first ones is, results aren't directly tied to management decision-making. You can't get the results out in time. They're so old that the managers look at them and saying, I can't make use of that information, it's too old for me to make a decision on. The other one is that the objectives are really not clear or precisely stated or understood. And the last one is sort of a curious one, because sometimes you have a monitoring program that's extremely well designed, it does what it's supposed to do initially, but what happens is science catches up with you. And you have improvements in science, and so if you end up having your program reviewed by an outside group, you end up actually coming up to the point of view saying, hey, wait a minute, you guys just aren't up with the current science, and you need to end up changing your program. And that happens to all programs, not just in the science area, but also in the economics and social science areas. So I'm going to go through now and talk about sort of defining the monitoring objectives. And what I find interesting is that this is probably one of the harder things for people to actually do and to come up with an idea. What do users really want to know from the monitoring program? Usually the person who funds the organization that funds it likely provides some general requirements. They're usually in terms of general statements. They're not quantitatively stated, and that's understandable. And so you have to really work hard, actually, to translate those general statements into more specific monitoring objectives. Over the years, one of the things that we found that can be useful to do is actually outline your report, including all the tables and graphics with labels. And actually, you could write the whole report, except you just don't have the actual data values to put in the tables and graphics or the conclusions. When you get done writing that, if you look at it carefully, you can discern what your objectives really are, assuming your managers think that that's what you should be doing. Under the Environmental Monitoring and Assessment Program, or EMAP, actually early on in that program, all the resource groups in that were actually required to actually create such a report. so that they could help define what it is that they were really interested in monitoring. It was actually a very useful exercise. The other one is to actually take and say, okay, look, you're done, you're the head of the monitoring program, your management calls you and says, I need to know the results of the program. You've got 3 to 5 slides to present the results. What are you going to present to them? That can tell you what the highest priority objectives that you have. So that's another way of that you can identify what the objectives might be. You have to go through this process of translating general statements to quantitative objectives. The general statements work well for most presentations, and if you actually listen to Marianne talk about the National Wetland Condition Assessment, those were general sort of statements that are good for the initial sort of the high-level communication of the results, but they're not quantitatively stated enough to actually design the program. The other one is that the reality is that you have a lot more objectives than most people initially believe. And quite frankly, I can't see the bottom of my slides. Hopefully you can. The objectives will need to be prioritized. The last line, if you can't see it, is developing objectives is hard work, and it's an iterative process. Almost always, the initial objectives ask you to spend more money than you have available. That's just the natural state of things. Potential monitoring questions, I'll let you guys read these as opposed to me going over them. But in general, the questions that we're focusing about on for probability surveys is the questions that talk about an entire aquatic resource, not what's going on at a single location. The other thing I'll end up stating is that I was actually at a meeting once with Park Service, and the manager there said, these aren't the types of questions they have to answer in some cases. In their case, the question was, I need to know whether I should buy or sell land associated with the national park. And as part of that decision, I need to include some consideration of the impact of the resource of interest in that particular case. It happened to be birds. It wasn't aquatic. So their questions tend to be a little bit more general or a little different, but you still have to translate those into something that one can use. These are an example of the types of questions associated with the wetlands. And if you go through and you look at that, those questions, you have to go through and actually require that you need to define the terms that are used into them. And if you look at the questions, they may not be sufficiently specific to know exactly what is required. When you say good, what does that mean? Do you need these things for just the entire United States, or do you want them for the 4 aggregated ecoregions? But what about the 4 different wetland types? Do you want them for the 4 different wetland types? So there's lots of different things that come up. And that's why I say there's a lot more objectives than you actually think about it. But these are the types of questions that would actually end up causing different decisions to be made about how do you allocate samples, the number of samples into different resources. The other one when I start thinking about the designs your objectives will start telling you something about what's the spatial domain or area that is of interest, what are the spatial units, what's the time domain, and so on. And I'll talk a little bit more about these. What indicators are required and will be reported and so on. And, my first comment about this is at the bottom is this is all jargon, and people don't even know how to answer the questions because they don't know what the terms mean. And terms do matter. In this particular case. So at least some of the definitions you can read here on the slides is the target population is the aquatic resource of interest. You say wetlands, well, we're going to have to define what we mean by the target population of wetlands of interest to the National Wetlands Condition Assessment or to the PNW study. what are you going to actually report on? That's going to drive what's going to be measured. What's the geographic area? And I'll give a slide later on that talks about this for the wetland condition assessment. What's the spatial units or the elements that you're going to measure on? And that seems like a little simple question, but for wetlands, it's actually a fairly hard question to answer. And what's the time domain that you're going to deal with? Is it for a single time period, or are you going to measure this annually over the next 10, 15, 20 years? And again, sort of what's the subgroups or the subregions that you want to report on? And it actually could be both time and space. So the target population for me is the collection of all the spatial temporal units in the aquatic resources of interest. A very simple statement, but defining that is actually extremely difficult. For me, a measurement is anything that resulted from the data collection event within the unit and using laboratory or field protocols, and everything's involved in what's called the response design. For me, the response is the spatial temporal unit resulting from reduction in processing the measurements. This is actually for people who have been involved in NARS for a while, is in most cases, we'll end up referring to these as indicators as opposed to responses. It's a slightly different reason, and the reason is associated with the next bullet. An indicator is what you're going to actually report. So it is the percent of the wetlands that are in good condition nationally. That's an indicator value. That's actually more consistent the way the word indicator is used for other, national reporting, like what's, the national, what's the GDP of the United States, or what's the unemployment rate? That's an economic indicator. So that's the reason, one of the reasons for doing it. And the other one is to make it sure that the indicator is like, okay, I've got to do something to summarize across spatial temporal units to get the inference, and how am I going to do that? And that's what we use is the inference design to do that. So something that's actually been fairly useful to think about is actually what's called, we call it STRIDE, spatial temporal response and inference design. There's really sort of four different, those are the four different components that you put together when you're actually thinking about designing a program. We're going to talk about it in the terms of designing a probability survey or a survey design, but these same components appear regardless of what type of study you're doing. Maybe you're doing a targeted study or a before or after control impact type study. You still have to answer these same questions. And it's useful to actually think about them in order to actually go through this entire process. So I'm going to go back to talk about the target populations for wetlands. There's a science definition of what a wetland is, and my guess is there's likely multiple definitions of what a wetland is in the science community. But there's also a regulatory definition. And for the National Wetland Condition Assessment, while information about the science definition of wetlands is important, you have to make up your own definition, and this is the short statement of that definition, what that target population definition is. It tells you what should be included, but it doesn't really tell you what the spatial unit is that you're going to use to collect the data on. How you're going to collect, do the field work. It's a written definition, and it's got to be precise enough to enable a field crew or somebody sitting in the office to determine if a site that they or a spatial unit that they're going to, whether the site they're looking at is in the target population or not in the target population. And for those involved in the evaluation of the wetland sites in 2011 and 2016, there are always a number of cases that come up where it is not clear whether the site is in or out because the target population definition is extremely difficult to be precise enough to cover all different conditions. So the target population really specifies what the spatial domain is and its spatial units. It's got to be clear and understandable. It's harder to define than most people expect. It's written. It's not given in terms of a GIS layer. For the National Wetland Condition Assessment, the spatial domain is the 48 contiguous United States. The spatial unit is actually any point location within that spatial domain. And the comment with the spatial unit is the view that the measurements or the responses that you get, that if you think about those, that they vary continuously across the wetland. So, for example, if you're looking at vegetation MMI, and you calculate the vegetation MMI for a point in one part of the Everglades, then, you know, you'll get a particular value. If you move, you know, half a mile away and you're still in the Everglades, you're going to get a different value. And so, you know, wetlands sort of varying from these sort of discrete, sort of small prairie potholes or other objects to these very large expanse of wetlands really cause a real issue in terms of saying, okay, well, what is the site or what is the spatial unit that we're going to end up measuring? And if you want to include all the different types of wetlands, the only conclusion that we could come to was that you really need the view, the spatial unit, as any point within the wetland, and so you could select two points, you know, 10 meters apart, and you could get two different answers. Would their field plots overlap? Absolutely. So yes, are they highly correlated? Absolutely. But you still end up thinking about the fact that the response can vary. So the first part of this is the same as the previous slide. The bottom part really talks more about the temporal domain. And for the wetland condition assessment, it really goes from 2011, and I've just at this point just said 2021 is the end of it. But the temporal units are the summer index periods for 2011, 2016, and 2021. The other years, we'd love to know what's going on, but we're not including them as part of the temporal units that we're actually surveying. The reporting domains actually are fairly complex. One, we want to report nationally. Two, we want to report on the four aggregated ecoregions. Three, we want to report on the four aggregated wetland types. And actually, under the four aggregated ecoregions, that's what was happened in 2011. And actually, in 2016, it's actually, five regions. You know, so I forgot, I'm erroring my slide. So then you want to report on the combinations of those. You have 12 reporting groups. So if you add those up, you basically have something on the order of over 20 different reporting domains that you want to report on. You're asking a lot you're going to sample 1,000 sites. You got 20 reporting domains. You got to make sure that you allocate the samples so that you end up getting data in all of these different combinations. So all of that is done, and you never actually have to think about how you're actually selecting sites. That's all the work has to be done to say this is what my requirements are for what the survey design has to satisfy. So the next slide is like currently is that thing. Okay, how am I going to do the sample? Well, we decided we're going to do a spatially balanced survey design, where the spatial unit is a point. We're going to select the 904 unique sites, and the reason there's 904 is because there's 96 sites that actually get sampled twice. For the temporal design for 2016, we actually said, well, we're going to resample 25% of the sites from approximately 25% of the sites are going to become from 2011, and we're going to do 75% new sites. We would have liked to have done 50% from 2011 and 50% from 2016, but because of the limitations of what was going on in 2011 that Mary Ann talked about in terms of what was going on in the West, in particular wetland types, we couldn't accomplish that, so we ended up backing off and doing 25 and 75. So when we looked at sort of the new sites, I'll just talk about that part of the design. We did one of the things that we did is we said, well, we can't just rely on Fish and Wildlife Service status and trends plots. But Fish and Wildlife Service actually has 4 square mile plots across the entire United States. And so we're going to actually select additional plots, just like Fish and Wildlife Service would do, to actually select those additional ones. Once you get those 4 square mile plots, we're going to rely on the National Wetland Inventory digital map, wetland data to actually populate those polygons with those plots with wetland polygons. If the plots happen to be Fish and Wildlife Status and Trends plots, we'll end up using the current Fish and Wildlife Service Status and Trends wetland polygons. And then within that, we actually ended up selecting an unequal probability sample, or think about it as a stratified sample if you want, for the 12 reporting groups. And then when we actually implemented the design, we actually implemented it to where it was stratified by state as well. And the reason for stratifying by state is strictly an administrative one, in that states need to be able to operate independently of each other. So you get this idea of what you're doing, the survey design, and in the previous one, we sort of indicated that you got to end up getting your information about where the resource is, and that's where the sample frame comes in. So our sample frame are wetland polygons that either come from status and trends plots or NWI 4 square mile plots. We know that sample frame is not a perfect representation of the National Wetland Condition Assessment target population. There is some undercoverage. For example, and I'll apologize to Nevada if this is incorrect, but I think Nevada's national digital map may be mapped at 1 to 250,000 scale, and it's a fairly old map. The question is that a good representation of the wetlands in Nevada? My guess would be that it would give you an undercoverage just because of the scale that the mapping was done. The issue is with undercoverage is basically when you get done with the study, you can't talk anything at all about the part of the wetland population that you wasn't included in the sample frame. It's just missed. The other one is the overcoverage. That one is not much of a problem from a statistical point of view. But if you have a large overcoverage, what it amounts to is you'd spend a lot more time evaluating sites that don't result in a site being in the target population. They're a non-part target thing. That costs money, so you'd like to end up having the sample frame shrink down to match the target population as much as possible without creating a large undercoverage problem. When you get done, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, is when you get two sets of data from doing the field implementation. One set is the one that you're always used to doing, is getting the responses, the field measurements. You only get those for the site sampled, and you can go through and you do all sorts of calculations and so on to get the final response value that you can analyze in the statistical summaries. The other data is about the site evaluations, and you have that for all the sites evaluated. That's important because it documents the implementation of the survey design, and we use that to actually estimate what the extent of the resource is or the size of the resource is, and as part of that process, we actually end up in looking at how the survey design is actually implemented. Unfortunately, for natural resources, survey designs are rarely implemented as planned exactly. You don't just look at the base sites. Some sites can't be sampled, so you end up using oversample sites in the terminology that we've all become used to using. We end up using that information so that we make sure that we can actually know what the design was as implemented, so we know exactly what the sample size was. And then we need to actually go through and do that changes of do adjustment of what the weights are, so with the weights are reflect how the design was implemented, not how it was planned. And that actually enables us to make estimates of extent and condition. So hypothetical news release, some people have seen this before. 6% of the wetlands are in good condition nationally based on a VMMI. It's 100 wetland sites were sampled in each of three large geographic regions. And I'm sure the story went on, but that's what you know. This, hypothetically, you say, okay, well, are the study results correct? If you were reading that in the paper, would you believe it or not? They sampled 300 wetland sites with 100 in each of three regions, and you know, since 60% were in good condition, that 180 sites of those were in good condition. Well, what do we need to know? Well, we need to know, where are the wetland acres by region? How many wetland acres are in the west, the plains, and the east? And we need to know the number of sites in good condition by region. So maybe the first case of the result, case A, is what happened. You get 60 sites out of 100 in good condition to each region. You go through and you do the appropriate weighting, which is 1,000 divided by 100, or 12,000 divided by 100, or 2,000 divided by 100, and you go through and you figure out what the correct weights using the weights, and you find out that 6% are in good condition. Well, maybe that's not what happened. What happened is, in case B, you got 80, 40, and 60. If you just do an unweighted estimate, you get an answer of 60, which is what they reported. But the reality is you didn't sample with equal intensity in each of the different regions, so you need to do a weighted estimate or weighted mean, and you get the answer of 45%. So it depends upon what did they do the correct analysis to match the survey design. When you get done with the site evaluation, you end up getting up with a number of sets of different types of sites. The sample populations are those sites that you know are eligible and you got responses for. Then you get some other sites that you know were eligible, but you didn't get a response because the landowner denied access, or you couldn't get access, or physical access, or some other reason. And then there's the number of sites that you evaluated that you found out that were a non-target. In some cases, you actually may not know whether the site is in the target population or not. We choose not to actually have that category. We presume that we know that the site is either in or out of the population. So we end up using these categories when we do the weight adjustment. The next one is a very busy slide that I don't expect anybody to go through and read, but it's there for people who want to look at it later on. It gives the process for actually how we end up doing the weight adjustment based upon those classes, based upon those categories. The process appears really complicated, but it's actually, sort of computationally, it's actually very simple to do. But it requires decisions to be made on what classes we want to use for adjusting the weights. And that's a decision that you need a little bit of knowledge to actually make to do that. So to begin with, I want to start out with sort of how do you calculate the initial design weights to begin with? And I use an example for an unequal probability sample. Excuse me. So we're going to do 300 sites with unequal probability by, two ecoregions and two wetland types. You're going to put 75 sites in each one. So actually the weights turn out to be, the size of the resource divided by 75. So, there's 1,831 acres in the entire population, but only 160 of those are in the Xeric woody classification. So when you actually initially do it, the wetland weight is for that class is 2.133, and it's just 160 divided by 75. It's not terribly difficult to do. When you actually draw the sample, what happens is since it's an unequal probability sample, you aren't guaranteed to get 75 sites in each of the four categories. So you get 80, 71, 73, or 76. And so when you actually end up looking and summing up the weights for each one of the categories, they don't add up to the correct thing. So instead of getting 160, the weight summing up to 160 for that one class, they add up to 162. They're close, but they're not exact. if you did a stratified sample, the sum of the weights would be exactly equal to the acres in each of the classes. So so we ended up doing the survey of 300, or designed with 300 sites in it. You actually wanted to only get a sample of 150 sites when you get out of the field. So you selected the sample of 300. In order to get 150 sites sampled, you actually had to evaluate 213. So the as implemented design actually doesn't have a sample size of 300. It has a sample size of 213 because, of course, but the sites were actually evaluated in the appropriate order, so it was like the first 213 in the list. So what do you do? One simple adjustment is you say, well, I think it doesn't make any difference. The only class I need is just all the wetlands within the study area. So I've got one class that has 1,831 acres in it. The adjustment factor you're going to end up using is 1,831 divided by the sum of the weights for the entire thing, which is 1,321 out of the 213 sites evaluated. The adjustment factor is 1.38. You multiply the original weights by that number, and now you have the adjusted weights. So, you know, that's a very simple adjustment that one can make. And if this next slide, the top is exactly the same, if you look at the bottom of it, you'll end up seeing that the adjusted weights for the Xeric woody class is now 2.955 compared to the initial weight of 2.133. And that's because of the way the design was implemented. And that's the important part that we need to end up doing as part of the weight adjustment process. Now, that was a very sort of simple example, and it's probably not the way I would have implemented that particular thing to begin with. But if, when you think about the weight calculations, you start off with sort of, first off, you have to calculate the initial weights associated, the weights associated with the initial design as you designed it. That we do when we select the sites to begin with. Then you want to adjust the weights for the fact that the sample size isn't the sample size is the number of sites evaluated, not just the sites sampled. So I just gave you a simple example of how you would change the weights to deal with the as-implemented design. You can also do other weight adjustments to address sample frame imperfections and the inability of the target sample target sites, and we've done that in certain situations for some studies. It goes through exactly the same process, it's just a different set of sites that you end up making use of. When you make these weight adjustment processes, part in the back of your mind when you're thinking about these is, and particularly when you're selecting the classes, is you're saying, okay, if I select this class of all the wetlands in the study that we just talked about, are the sites that couldn't sample missing completely at random. And let's say that you believe that the sites that I couldn't sample, you know, they were the ones that were in the mountainous region. I have more of those, you know, that I can't reach than the ones that are in the Xeric region. Well, in that case, you'd say, well, wait a minute, making the assumption that they're missing completely random over the whole region is not a good assumption. I maybe ought to break it into two classes and saying I need to do one weight adjustment for the mountainous region, another weight adjustment for the Xeric region. And the similar thing could be done for the different wetland types. But these are some of the terms that you'll end up finding some people end up using and how they can impact the way that you do the weight adjustment. So population estimates. One of the things is that most people are not used to is estimating what the size of the resource or the extent of the resource. Why do you care? Well, one thing is in most cases for the surveys we do, we don't know what the size of the target population is. We don't know what the total number of wetland acres in the United States are. Fish and Wildlife Service actually has a program to estimate that. based on their Fish and Wildlife Status and Trends network, and so they estimate it for the set of target population of wetlands that they're interested in. So we need to be able to estimate that size of it is. The other one is that we might want to estimate, you know, okay, sort of why within the target population, we couldn't sample all the sites that were actually target sites. So why were some of the sites not sampled? And the other reason, the other thing we might do is you say, well, I want to estimate the size of the non-target population, which gives an idea of, well, how much of the sample frame is there that I, you know, I really shouldn't have included. And I'll give you some examples of that in a minute. So if you actually wanted to calculate the estimates for the, you know, whether it was the size of the target population, this is actually, if you had the data file all set up, this is all the code that you actually need to actually do those estimates. It's, you know, all the work is done is getting the data up to this point. But once you get to this point, the estimation process itself is very easy, assuming, of course, you know R and, you know, et cetera, which is what the workshop would do for those people in the Pacific Northwest. So you went through and you ran that code. Take a little bit here on this one. The first set, three rows on national, you're saying, I'm making national estimates, and of that, of the sample frame, 82% of the sample frame is estimated to be in the target population for NWSCA, and 18% is not. But that's also reflected in the fact that, you know, that means that, you know, 95 million acres are in the target population, and about 20 million is not in the target population. So that those are the numbers that you can get, and they both have standard error estimates and then confidence interval estimates associated with them. And you'll notice that whether things are in target or non-target population differs if you look at different wetland classes. So the estuaries, almost all of them are in the target population, and if you look at let's say whatever they say, oh, do the last one at the bottom of the page, the PUB, PABs, and you know, you'll end up finding that basically, you know, less than 50% of those happen to actually end up in the target population. One of the questions might be is why. If you go to the next one, is saying, okay, well, we estimated that, you know, 82% of the population was in the target of the of the sample frame was in the target population, or 94 million acres on line about six. You take a look at that and you say, well, but we could only end up sampling 65% of that. So that's the size of the sampled population, 65%. And that's only 62 million acres with their appropriate confidence intervals. What's the main reason why you couldn't end up sampling things? In most cases, the reason is that access was denied. And that's a little bit strong term. It's really access wasn't obtained. In many cases, it was just the landowner. You never could contact the landowner. So if you wanted to end up getting the sample population a more accurately, more closely be the target population, you'd end up spending more effort on figuring out how could I improve the landowner access process to get more access available. And you'll see that again differs by the different wetland classes. If you take a look at the non-target population, again, these 20 million acres that in the sample frame that didn't turn out to be wetlands of interest to National Wetland Condition Assessment, the main reason was, hey, they're non-target. 48% of them were in their active cropping, 48%, or about 9-10 million acres. Could you improve the sample frame to eliminate those? Depends, maybe, maybe not. You know, that's something for others other than me to end up deciding. In most cases, you know, there were also some wetland types that they were wetlands, the non-target wetland type. It is a wetland, but it's not a type of wetland that is included in National Wetland Condition Assessment. And again, those differ by the different wetland classes. So that's where I'm going to end. Just to give you an idea of sort of, you know, that's a little bit of the design, sort of the design process, a little bit of sort of what you end up having to do in terms of using the site evaluation information to actually adjust the weights, and then a little bit of information about how you actually turn those around and actually make estimates. One of the things that when you think about making those estimates, making the estimates are really very simple. They are nothing more than weighted means. It's the sum of the weights for those that are included, in, let's say, in the class of being in good condition, divided by the sum of all the weight. That's the estimate. So getting the right estimate is all about getting the right weight. With that, I'll stop and let others talk.
Tony, thank you very much. Folks, do we have questions? That's a lot to absorb. I guess I have one for it, just as a perspective. Tony, how much adjustment of the weights had to be done after 2011?
I'm not sure how to answer that question. There was actually quite a bit of adjustment, and I don't remember the exact classes that we ended up using. one of the things that we tend to do is, one, make sure that we adjust the weight so that the sample frame wetland area that we have actually matches, it actually is preserved for each of the states. Or we either do that or we make sure that it matches by the aggregated ecoregions that are of interest to us. So we may end up doing that. The other one is that we'll end up doing adjustments that includes the different wetland types. So it's usually a combination of wetland types, time and aggregated ecoregion, and the state, and state together. So you look at all those classes, and then the question is do you have enough sites in each of those classes to actually where you can do the weight adjustment? And I don't remember the details about whether we had to collapse those or whatever. Eventually we'll have a paper out that describes that process, but whenever Mary finishes her special issue. But that's a fairly typical thing that you end up doing it, and the similar thing goes on for the other resources. But when you choose the classes, you typically are trying to choose them to sort of say, wait a minute, when I end up doing additional sites, am I preferentially, dropping sites because, not on purpose, but or more sites being dropped in this wetland type or in this aggregated ecoregion or in this state because of the following regions, and so you want to adjust the weights based on that information. There's some decisions that have to be made during that process, and that's the sort of the, I don't know, it's not, I was going to say the science behind it, but it's the art behind the survey design process. One thing that I guess I want to bring up, too, is we talked a little bit about the difference between 2011 and 2016 design, and one of the reasons, for using the status and trend, the extra 2x2 square mile plots areas to get more sites in the west, and also to address the issue of we were getting multiple sites within the same 4 square mile plot. So we just really didn't have enough wetland polygons or 4 square mile plots around to actually spread the sample out. That's why we ended up doing the extra 200 4 square mile plots in each stage. That certainly helped, but it clearly didn't solve the entire problem, because if you put another 200 4 square mile plots in the state of Nevada, you're still going to end up having most of those 200 4 square mile plots not have a lot of wetland polygons in them. It's just a dry state. I think for the 2021, we have to actually address that issue in the next design.
Huh. Okay.
Mary Ann, there's a question in the chat box.
Yes, I was just about to mention that. There are two ways, actually, of asking questions. You can type them in the chat box, which is probably a little bit easier. The other thing is that in Adobe, it has you have the ability to raise your hand. I suspect it's probably easier with a group this size to do it in the chat box. Jennifer Hsu wanted to ask, can you explain the statement that 50 sample points are needed in context of the target population?
Oh, that's a good question. Thank you, Jennifer, for asking. The focus of the focus of most of the stuff that's done in the wetland condition assessment, or many of the studies we get involved with, is basically estimating proportions. So I want to estimate, the proportion of the wetlands that are in good condition. The reason that's important is that estimating proportions, if you take a very simple view of a binomial population, well, if you're estimating a proportion, then you know what the variance is. The variance is the true proportion times 1 minus the true proportion divided by the sample size. If you use that as a basis, you can end up actually getting an idea of, if I want to estimate a quantity within plus or minus 10-12%, and the true proportion is around 50%, then you need about 50 samples in order to estimate that within 90-95% confidence. And I could go do the exact calculation somewhere, but that's where the 50 sort of comes from. If you're trying to estimate the mean soil concentration of a metal in the soil,